From the Denker studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. In the program, we're looking at unprocessed rape kits. The issue has been in the local news lately after a city council member publicly questioned the number of untested kits held by the Salt Lake City Police Department. On TV crime shows, DNA evidence is entered into a database and out pops the name of a criminal. Our guest today is Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank, who says that the reality is much different from what you see on television.
There have only been a handful of circumstances where we've had unknown suspects, where we've gone to a database and been able to say, oh, here's a potential suspect. Most of the time, these cases are put together with good detective work, good police work, that says, here is the suspect, and then we do a comparative analysis based on the DNA that exists.
That and your local headlines coming up next on The Rundown. And welcome back to The Rundown. Coming up later on the show, a conversation with Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank. But first up, we have these headlines. State Representative David Lifferth has apologized over his comment that the NAACP is a, quote, racist organization. The Eagle Mountain Republican, who made the remark after NBA Commissioner Adam Silver banned Donald Sterling from the League for Life on Tuesday, said in a blog post Thursday that it was in, quote, poor taste and insensitive to others. Lifferth said that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People is not a racist organization and that his logic was flawed. Janetta Williams of the NAACP's Salt Lake chapter says her group accepted his apology. On Tuesday, Lifferth tweeted, "We should have known Don Sterling was a racist when he gave money to the NAACP." At the urging of officials in three southern Utah counties, the Utah Wildlife Board is pressing federal land managers to deal with an overpopulation of wild horses on the range. Board members at a meeting in Salt Lake City on Thursday agreed to send a letter to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and U.S. Bureau of Land Management State Director Juan Palma, urging a reduction in the number of horses. Officials in Iron, Beaver, and San Pete counties have expressed concern over the issue of rangeland degradation and the risks it poses to both livestock and wildlife. Livestock and hunting group representatives also backed the request. According to the BLM, Utah is home to 3,245 wild horses and burros, well above the, quote, appropriate management level of 1,956. Congressman Chris Stewart says he's worried about paramilitary units at the Bureau of Land Management. What is he proposing to do about it? I posed that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
Yeah, so this harkens back to the Clive and Bundy situation we've been talking about for a few weeks. If you remember seeing all the pictures, the video, they were the BLM brought in what looked like, you know, like a SWAT-like team. They had like guys, you know, with heavy vests and big guns facing off with this armed civilian militia that, you know, were wearing cowboy hats and on horses. And it really was a pretty scary situation. Stewart saw this when he was in Utah on TV. He got pretty upset about what he says was this heavy paramilitary force he said the BLM brought in. And Stewart's one who sits on the House Appropriations Committee, and he says he wants to use his position to try and kill the funding for heavy forces at places like the BLM, EPA, IRS. He says they're regulatory agencies, and they have no need for these type of law enforcement, heavy military kind of units. On their part, the BLM notes it has like 300 law enforcement officials for the millions of acres that it manages. It does not have a SWAT team. And if the law enforcement that was there was not there to round up the cattle, it was because of this, you know, tinderbox that had been created by the kind of armed militia.
Interesting. And he's trying to do this through legislation?
Yeah, through the funding process. So, if you want to pay for something in the federal government, you got to go through appropriations. So he's going to use his seat there. I'm not sure, you know, what traction we'll get, but certainly there have been a lot of Republicans upset about these quote-unquote paramilitary units.
All right. Thomas, in other news, in the last 5 years, Congress has only set aside one area for wilderness, and other bills are stalled. Is there another path that environmentalists are seeking?
You know, in tomorrow's Tribune, I really explore this. It is kind of related to this dust-up in the West with Clive and Bundy and kind of the Sagebrush Rebellion echoes. And there's a lot of fear surrounding the idea that President Obama is going to use the Antiquities Act, his unilateral power to name more monuments. May not happen this year in an election cycle, but then he has 2 years left. He's not running for re-election, and he could do this to kind of assuage the environmental groups who were concerned about the lack of any movement to preserve public lands. The president even said it himself in the State of the Union that he plans to use that power. And I don't think there's anyone on any side who doesn't expect them to do that. There are a couple in Utah that are possibles, the Center Fell Swell area, Greater Canyonlands. And then there's the possible Cedar Mesa area that the Navajo Nation has been trying to pass through Congress's wilderness and gotten nowhere, and has actually met with the Interior Secretary recently to ask for a national monument if this process doesn't work.
Well, so it's probably going to happen. Just where it's going to be or where they are going to be is another thing. Finally, tomorrow is the White House Correspondents Association dinner. It's always a kind of fascinating affair. Do you plan to take any selfies with Kevin Spacey?
You know, I will look for him. That's for sure. I'll keep my eye out. I saw him last year briefly, but didn't get a chance to get a picture with him. It is amazing how much this dinner has changed, even in my time here. You know, my first dinner, you know, there were obviously celebrities there. But they weren't to the degree they are now. And it was amazing. A couple years ago, I got pushed into a corner with Kim Kardashian, and I'm sitting there thinking, who are you and why are you famous? Like, I don't get it. Why are you at a press dinner? It seems like there has been somewhat of an effort to try to stop being so much celebrity. I will note that beyond myself, John Huntsman and his wife Mary Kay are going to be there tomorrow. There might be a couple other Utahns in the crowd. It is definitely become the premier party, and I'm going to try to stop doing the star sniffing, as they say.
Best of luck with that. It's usually a pretty big venue for comedy as well, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
It really is. You know, one of my favorite, Joel McHale from the, I think Community was the TV show he was on, and The Soup, I think he does. He's going to be the headliner this year. You know, it is one of those things I write in a column for Sunday about how, you know, yes, it is become this celebrity thing. It's about comedy, but it also is nice in many ways to actually have an event where it's not me going through seven secretaries to try to, you know, get a comment or actually speak to someone who has, you know, the decision making power. This is a night when you can put the notebook down and actually talk to somebody who is in a position of power. And it's nice to have these moments when it's not, you know, side versus the other side. It's actually, hey, we're just people, even if we're wearing, you know, penguin suits.
Thomas Burr is Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes. He joins us each Friday for this conversation. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And now on The Rundown, we turn to a conversation with Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank. After receiving some criticism at the Salt Lake City Council over the number of unprocessed rape kits held by the Salt Lake City Police Department, Chief Burbank unveiled a plan to revisit that evidence and to post information on 625 rape cases online while protecting the identity of victims. We invited Chief Burbank into the studio to talk more about this initiative and about the processing of evidence in rape cases. Chief Burbank, thanks very much for coming in today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Between 2003 and 2011, about 1,000 rape kits were collected in Salt Lake City. Of those, 788 weren't sent in for analysis. I think 625 of those remain in evidence. This is according to reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. This got a little bit of a blip in the news with members or a member of the city council voicing concerns over the number of unprocessed rape kits. Why anywhere, but particularly here in Salt Lake City, why are there unprocessed rape kits?
Well, what you have to understand is that is a physical examination that has taken place of the victims of rape, and we do that regardless of the circumstance because there may be evidence. Very similar. I mean, if we had a homicide in this room, we would come in and we would gather everything in this room, and then detectives would make a determination as to what is valued and what needs to be processed. And there's many different ways to process it, DNA just being one of those avenues. And so when you look at the circumstances regarding any crime scene investigation or any investigation into a crime, you have to make a determination. What is the value? And so in a lot of circumstances, these cases represent individuals where someone says, this person is responsible for committing a rape against me. And the person says, no, we had consensual sex. And so the debate is not whether or not that person is, you know, subject. So there's no specific value in the DNA evidence. Now, you will certainly get advocates that say, well, this person may have done it multiple times or anything else. But what needs to be realized, it's a limited resource, right, as far as the crime lab, as far as detectives and everything else. There is not a case that a detective has ever come and said, we want to process some evidence, and I've said, or anyone in the police department has ever said, no, we don't have money, we don't have time, we don't have resources. If it is part of the investigative process, we go find money. In fact, I've gone to the council in years past and gotten more money specifically for cold case homicide investigations, which one of them was a rape that we solved 25 years later. So that's part of the reason that we also don't destroy these kits. I mean, it's potential evidence. We have it there in the event that it needs to be processed. Evidence goes to a specific crime. We don't create a database, nor is that the intention of the police department, on every piece of evidence that comes in, which in a year amounts to about 27,000 pieces of evidence. And in this day and age, everything in this room potentially has your DNA because you live and work in this environment that we could get it from.
One of the concerns of people who talk about this is that it costs money to process these, and that's one of the reasons that police departments make the decision not to process them. Essentially, that doesn't factor into it.
Well, it factors into it in the respect of I have so much evidence that comes in every single year that we make a determination. And in fact, you know what? I would love to process more evidence that relates to property crimes. But because of the nature of those crimes and everything else, because of the expense associated and the backlog at the lab, we are unable to do that, right? It is not feasible because of the situation. Again, the lab is a limited resource. Investigative time is a limited resource. We evaluate every single case and say this is the best avenue in order to solve that specific case and ultimately to prevent crime from occurring, right? To keep the public safe. And so if you arbitrarily say, whether it's rape investigations, homicide investigations, that every piece of evidence will go regardless of the circumstance, right? In some cases, we have circumstances where it is 2 weeks after the fact, which evidentiary, you know, the value to that is slim to none, and chances of us finding something are very, very hard to do. So if we process that case, right, and we send everything, it's going to impact somewhere else. I mean, there is no question about it because we just don't have, you know, unlimited resources in order to deal with it. And so it is always an investigator, the assigned detective's decision as to whether or not to process things. And it is never based on we don't have enough money or we don't have enough time and energy. If it is valuable to solving a case, then we make sure it gets processed.
Another argument people make is that you want to have a likelihood of conviction, that prosecutors in particular want to have a likelihood of conviction before sending these rape kits in. It would seem unlikely that if you had a case in which it was a strong case that you were going to have a conviction based on rape, that you wouldn't process the rape kit because you already had enough evidence pointing towards a perpetrator.
Well, certainly that factors into it. I mean, there's a bunch of different things that play into whether or not we process any piece of evidence, and part of it is the prosecution that ultimately will take place. And we have very few circumstances, so you understand. I mean, statistically, 90% of these cases, unfortunately, are known suspects. And so it is not the aha moment that people see on TV. That, again, we are clouded by what appears on TV all the time. There have only been a handful of circumstances where we've had unknown suspects, where we've gone to a database and been able to say, oh, here's a potential suspect. Most of the time, these cases are put together with good detective work, good police work that says, here is the suspect, and then we do a comparative analysis based on the DNA that exists. And that is how more crimes are solved. Again, very rare that we all of a sudden just put this unknown suspect. The other thing that is important to note is we have very few, if any, circumstances of these stranger abductions and rapes occurring, you know, along the parkway or anything else. And, you know, we have had those in the past, but thankfully Salt Lake City is a relatively safe place to live, work, and play. And so we don't have a lot of those situations where we're looking for people.
Right. The statistics show that for rape, most often it's somebody you know, it's even somebody you're dating.
Yes. And that is a sad commentary on society. It truly is that the people, and especially the thing that is most alarming is when you talk about children or underage individuals, the majority of those suspects are trusted individuals to that child. And that is even more scary.
How does Salt Lake City compare as far as number or percentage of rape kits that go unprocessed? I mentioned that there were 600 or something sitting in the crime lab versus versus what at a national level? I don't know if you know that or in other cities.
Not that I could quote. I mean, I've heard something. I mean, and obviously if you have a large city that has a large police force bringing in lots of things, I mean, as many as 10,000 kits have been, you know, talked about in other cities. So there's a bunch that, again, the thing that is important, because this did result from some discussion as far as why we're sitting here. But actually, it's a process that we've been working on for a long time. I mean, the discussion between the crime lab and the district attorney's office and everything else had been going on long before I ever got questioned about this in city council. And so we should always be asking, what are we doing and why are we doing it? Again, my concern is not the fact that someone's asking about these cases and asking, are we doing the right thing? And that's why I went forward and said, no, we'll put it on the webpage. We're not, there's nothing to hide within the police department. Where I have concern is when someone questions the integrity or the dedication of the officers, the detectives that are investigating these, because in some cases, they have to be told, okay, go home for a change, right? They work these things and they are advocates for the victims in most circumstances. In fact, very strong advocates that actually do put a lot of pressure on the district attorney's office. A tremendous amount of pressure on the crime lab. I mean, I've had some issues with the crime lab and the time they take to process some of our cases. And so that's where I become very concerned, because I see the dedication firsthand and what goes into it.
You know, and people have mentioned, and this gets talked about in this context of unprocessed rape kits, but I guess probably, you know, if you're looking at other evidence as well, that the crime lab is underfunded, that it doesn't have enough money to deal with what it has to deal with, I guess. I don't know. Do you think that that's maybe part of it?
Well, it certainly is part of it. One of the things that we are looking at in Salt Lake City is developing some public-private partnerships with labs, because there's been some studies done by the National Academy of Sciences and others that say, you know, probably police organizations are not the best to be running these high-tech labs. And really it is. It's very hard to hire chemists, keep them relevant, and have the government pay the same that a private entity is paying.
Right.
And so if we can develop partnerships where we can get evidence processed quicker, because to process DNA is an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But in some cases, we have waited as long as 6-7 months to have things processed. We run into the same thing with processing narcotics, those types of things. It takes far too long. And so if we are going to be the most efficient and effective, we need to reduce the amount of time that it spends in the lab and make it easier for us to process things that we decide are important.
You know, I want to go back to the rape kits for a second and ask. You mentioned that some don't get processed based on basically decisions by detectives, but I'm wondering how long they end up sitting on the shelves. I mean, is there kind of expiration date at which point someone makes the decision that, all right, this is no longer valid evidence? Or,
well, so, I mean, we make, again, those decisions all the time and purge evidence based on, do we have conclusion in a matter? Is there arrest made? Is there prosecution made? I mean, there's a bunch of different reasons to why something might be destroyed. But to call it a backlog is not accurate, because this is just a volume of evidence that sits there. And then we make a determination what's valuable. And so if there is still potential value in that kit, I mean, it doesn't expire, right? We retain it. You know, there's costs associated and everything else with space and storage and all those types of things. But it's something that if we still feel there's evidentiary value in it, then we maintain that, right? If there's value to a prosecution, we maintain that. So this goes for all evidence. I mean, that's the thing that people need to understand. I mean, this may be a pencil that we seized off a crime scene at some point 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago in some cases, that still has potential evidentiary value. And in some cases, we've had things that we have seized prior to DNA becoming a viable solution that we have had in our evidence room, that as DNA has developed, we've now been able to process some of those pieces of evidence. And so to not get rid of those, to actually save those and maintain them, provides some value to us.
That's fascinating. You didn't know the relevance of it. So you're saving things that you might not know have relevance and at some point in the future could be used to solve a crime.
It is fascinating. I mean, this is an area of police work, of law enforcement, that is just expanding exponentially every single day, it seems. And the technology changes and improves, and the ability to identify, you know, from very small things. What you don't realize is the fact that I'm touching this table now, I've left my DNA on here that can be lifted, can be processed, and can ultimately identify and demonstrate whether or not I'm here.
So, okay, I'm going to go back again to In the wake of the discussion with the city council about these rape kits, you announced a transparency project in order to track the kits and make the process more accountable. Can you explain what this transparency project is, what it does, and what it hopes to accomplish?
Well, so the one thing that I want to say is, again, we were working on this prior to. The decision to actually make it public was certainly brought about by, you know, hey, there's a lot of outcry on this all of a sudden, and people are questioning. And so the police department has nothing to hide in this particular area. And I think this is unique across the country. And what we're going to do is we are going to put on our webpage, you know, we're going to take the identifiers out because we certainly don't want to prejudice a case or have a victim be exposed or anything else. So we're actually doing away with our tradition, not doing away with, we're maintaining our case numbers, but we're identifying them on the webpage just based on a number one, the oldest case.
Anonymizing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are going to work through it and we're going to evaluate the evidence, make a determination why. We're willing to say this is why we made the determination we did. And in the event that we're going to send it to the lab, we'll talk about the date and time we send it to the lab, when we get it back from the lab, what the results are, and ultimately what the prosecution is. And so that's why the partnership with both the state and the district attorney's office to say, hey, there's nothing to hide in this process. And we're willing to put it on there so everyone can look and see this is exactly what we're doing with these old cases. If we find cases that we've handled inappropriately, well, then that's on the police department and on me to make sure that we handle those appropriately in the future as well as those past cases. But also, we're going to identify and say, hey, this is the reason that this case is sitting here and what we're not doing or what we are doing with it and how long it takes to process.
So this will be publicly available online, essentially. Is that right? But it'll be anonymous. I
mean, yes, it'll be anonymous, so you can't link it to a specific case. Again, because if there is potential for prosecution, we don't want to prejudice that, and we would never want to put a victim in the place that they might be exposed to something. But no, we're putting it out there just based on we have this many cases potentially to process, and here's what it is, and here's the circumstance. So it'll be on our webpage at slcpd.com and kind of ready to go.
Can complainants track their own cases? I mean, people who do have evidence processing, or they won't be able to tell that it's there.
They won't be able to tell because this is not a process. So if you are the victim of a crime, we will inform you about what's going on and all the specifics and everything else and give you exact details, right? This is not the avenue for us to inform our victims because we've always done that. This is just an avenue that the public can look if they have questions about how these things are processed and identify, you know, this is the process.
Will it speed up rape kit processing, or is this is kind of working through the backlog?
Again, sorry, to say it's a backlog because, right, let's just take case number 12, the 12th case that we have going back. It may have no evidentiary value, and as the review takes place, we're going to say, you know what, this is why there's no evidentiary value and why we're not going to go forward with the processing of this kit. So it really is not a backlog. We're not waiting to have these processed. But what it will do, right, is hopefully raise the level of concern within the state with the people to put pressure on the politicians to say there is a better way we need to support, fund, whether it's the state lab, a public-private partnership, or move forward so that we can do more things. There are, again, places in this country that are processing DNA relatively quickly and processing a larger quantity of DNA so it expands into property crimes and some of those other areas, and they're having successful prosecutions based on some of the DNA evidence that they're able to obtain. Again, comparative analysis. Right. Very rarely do you put it in there and all of a sudden it comes back, oh, this guy's the suspect. But what you do is you have a group of people and you think, you might be the one. You get a sample from you, you compare it to a sample obtained from the crime scene,
right,
and then you're able to say, you were there, and that develops your good case.
Right. Here's a question. I know that some cities have committed to processing all of their rape kits. What do you think about that?
Again, to arbitrarily say that all of those cases have value, I don't care if you have the greatest crime lab in the world and the most capacity in the nation. That is still a limited resource, and if you arbitrarily say this crime, every single piece of evidence from this particular type of crime, regardless of what the value is going to be processed, you are now prioritizing that above everything else. And so you are going to push homicide cases, you're going to push property, whatever it may be, back or further. I mean, that is part of the backlog that's created because only so much volume can be handled. And so that is the reality in which we live in. But the thing that I can't emphasize enough, these are not cases where a detective comes and says, oh, geez, if I can only process this piece of evidence, I'd solve the case. If they think they can, it goes to the lab and gets processed. Now, sometimes it takes overly long, which is what we're working on. But never once do we deny and say, oh, no, we don't have the funding, we don't have the resources, and we're not going to do this. If they think there's value, it gets processed.
Right. Okay, so going back to the Transparency Project, putting this thing online and allowing this, how long has that idea been in the works, and where does that idea come from? Is this innovative from Salt Lake City Police?
So the idea to actually post it all online was something that came to me as I was having discussion with the city council and everything else. The process of working through this, I mean, I have been working on a public-private partnership to enable us to do more DNA processing for about a year and a half, 2 years now. I mean, we've been working on a new evidence crime lab facility. We're still in the old building as far as that function in the police department. And so we are working on that process. So this has been ongoing for 4 or 5 years as far as developing capacity in order to deal with this issue. But as far as, okay, we're now going to post it, this is a unique thing that I don't think anywhere else in the country is actually posting. I mean, it was, again, something that I am very committed to making sure that the public has access to what goes on in the police department. So if people have questions about the police department, we want to say, here's an avenue that you can have those questions answered.
And is this is the transparency site up and running already?
It should be. We targeted the first of the month.
Okay,
so how the process will work is the detectives are starting with the oldest cases, going through the process of evaluating everything, and then those will start appearing online. And it may be something that they process really quickly and we'll get a bunch up front. It may be a slower process because this is really about addressing those cases, making sure that the police department, right, both past and present, are handling these things appropriately, doing the right thing. And if there is evidentiary value, we want it processed. And if it ultimately results in, hey, we can hold somebody accountable for a crime they've committed that they have not been, whether it's 5 years or 20 years old, we are going to do that. And so it is really an intensive process that is, as far as investigative work, it's a big deal.
And it probably has costs associated with it. Or what are the costs of this project?
Well, the cost right now, I mean, certainly there is a cost in processing as far as the state lab and everything's concerned. But really, the human resource cost is what it's all about right now, because you are having people specifically go through these cases one by one, very methodically, making sure that we've done the right thing. Mm. It's a very similar approach to how we handle cold case homicides. Mm. We have, those never go away, no matter how old they are. And so we have detectives that review that. Is there more evidence? Are there more individuals, suspects, or anything else that we can identify and move that case forward? And so it is a labor-intensive process, but it's one that we're committed to make sure, right, that we are doing the right thing, both past and present.
Finally, because we've been talking about the processing of rape kits and DNA evidence in general, but we've been kind of leaving aside any talk about rape itself, and I thought that maybe we could, for just a moment, talk about, you mentioned that it's not generally an unknown suspect who is jumping out of the shadows or whatever. It's people who are acquaintances, et cetera. I wanted to ask about how prevalent rape is in Salt Lake City, but also how the Salt Lake City police treat victims, because I know treating victims of rape is a sort of special circumstance.
It is extremely special, and it's one that we need to be sensitive to, and it's one that we just don't put anyone in there to be a detective to handle follow-up. Every single police officer has the potential of being a first responder to a rape situation.
Right.
And it is something that, we are our own worst enemies when it comes to this. I mean, because we have been insensitive in the past, and we probably haven't handled things. In fact, it wasn't too long ago when I first hired on that there was a lot of talk, not just among police officers, but in the community in general. If you were a spouse, if you were acquainted, if you were dating or everything else, that there's some entitlement and, silly nonsense like that. And so I think part of what is most concerning and alarming about this, again, is the frequency at which people that we know, trust, and care about are the ones that are responsible for victimizing us. And that is very scary. And the other thing is this is a case, because of the personal nature of it, that difficult to process, difficult to come forward and talk about. In fact, I would dare say that the most underreported type of crime that exists are sexual assaults involving males. Right? Because that is not something that a lot of people are comfortable with. There's a tremendous amount of stigma attached to that. And so those are the types of things that we need to be sensitive about. And all the time, there are cases that are reported to either the YWCA, Rape Recovery, where you have victims that are reluctant to participate in the process, that because of the stigma, because of the circumstances and everything else, don't even in some cases want to notify the police. Mm-hmm. So it is very concerning for us, and part of this openness is hopefully to say, no, we take this very seriously and we'll do all we can. Thankfully, we have only, but this is the hard thing about statistics, because when I say, you know, we have only, I mean, we have anywhere between 90 and 100 and so many rapes a year. One victim is far too many, and I know I say that, and you've heard it from me before. We society, should move to the point where we can say there's no victims of this type of crime or any crime at all, but it is very hard. And so when I say statistics are up, down, or anything else, the thing that we always need to remember is you have victims of crime, and even if you are the only victim of that crime that year, you don't feel that crime's down.
Final question. What if a person is raped? What is the process that they should do? What is the advice for them as far as reaching out to police, reaching out to deal with this crime?
Well, the most important thing is, one, you do not have to be a victim of this type of crime. No matter what your circumstances are, whether it's a casual date, whether it's a personal circumstance, whether it's a marriage or whether it's a stranger, you do not have to be a victim of this, and you need to care for yourself. And there's avenues, Rape Recovery, YWCA, the police department. Notify somebody. Care for yourself, right? And we will work through prosecution. We will work through everything that we need to, but it is important that people realize and recognize they do not have to be the victim of this crime. They are not responsible for it, and they need to stand up and say no and make sure that they care for themselves first and foremost.
Great. Chief Burbank, thanks very much for coming in and speaking with us about this again.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning in this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We'll be back next week. Enjoy your weekend. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace here on KCPW.